This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. That's Keith Cicola and his group Wild Band of Indians. Cicola is a songwriter, singer, and guitarist whose influences include traditional Native music along with Neil Young, Bruce Springsteen, and Bob Dylan. He shared the stage with such groups as the Indigo Girls, Pearl Jam, and Nirvana. Cicola is half Anishinaabe, the tribe also known as Chippewa and Ojibwe. He grew up in northern Minnesota and now lives in Arizona. We're listening to his best-known song, Indian Cars. This somewhat tongue-in-cheek song about rundown cars on the reservation has been described as a contemporary Native American anthem. It was used in the Norman Jewison film Dance Me Outside. Cicola wrote the song in the early 80s and has included a version of it on each of his CDs. We're listening to the one on his new CD, Finger Monkey.
Explain. I got to make it to this powwow tonight. Singing 49 down by the riverside. Looking for sugar, riding in my Indian car.
I asked Keith Cicola what car he was driving when he wrote Indian Cars.
My Indian car was actually a spy car. It was a 1967 Newport Chrysler. at the time I bought it, I bought it from a school teacher in the mid-70s, and he was trying to help me out. I was going to a community college up in northern Minnesota, and it was their second car, you know, a family second or third car, and it was just sitting in, you know, in their garage, and the school teacher asked, he knew I was going to school, and asked if I would want to buy this car. He said he'd sell it to me for $100, and it was still in good shape. You know, it turned over 100,000 miles. The front end had hit a bear at one time, so it was kind of crushed there. And after a while, you know, it'd be kind of, all these things happened to it. I guess the best thing that inspired me to buy it that day, at that time, it had an 8-track player that was worth $100. And so I went for it right away, and I called that car the spy car. In the early days of my playing career, we had a band called the Schwartz Brothers, and I'd arrived to the Schwartz Brothers gigs in my spy car. But that was the early days of the Indian car, you know, when the song was being written and everything like that. In the final days of this Indian car, the spy car, we actually rode it off a cliff over a mine pit in northern Minnesota, put a brick on the accelerator, and it dove 300 feet into the, you know, into the depths of this iron ore pit, and that's how, you know, now it's a legend up there.
So why was your band called the Schwartz Brothers?
Well, it was a theater band, you know, and we're in the late, here, let me say, is the late 70s, or, you know, in mid 70s, and actually we were all kind of like minorities at that time. I think, you know, it was a reference to the black sheep and that whole thing. We're all kind of misfits or something like that. And you know, there was 7 people in our band, and, you know, it was kind of a funny conglomeration of brother and sisterhood that started that whole collaboration between races and sexes as far as with music. And the Schwartz Brothers, we were a theater group, and we got to be a good band. You know, like, I myself, when I started playing, I wasn't that musically inept at all. But we had a singer who could sing the blues really good, and got hired in these bar gigs, you know. And you're playing guitar 6 months, and all of a sudden, you're playing for people. And our drummer was a guitar player, but we needed a drummer, so he switched. And we had a big keyboard player, and it was a fun first band, you know, a garage band that had somewhat success of a cult underground following in northern Minnesota.
So was there anyone named Schwartz in the Schwartz Brothers?
No one was named Schwartz. I think if you took the initials from every member's last name and put them together, and so we picked them from a hat, and that's what we came up with, SW, you know, or I don't know.
Now, I know that your song Indian Car has been described as something of an anthem for younger Native Americans, and I'm wondering if you could describe some of the more interesting situations that you've heard it played in, or that you've played it in.
Well, I know that, you know, there was a, up in Wyoming at a high school, the high school football team, they would use that song to rally the kids up on the bus before they'd go play their games. I thought that was interesting, you know, they'd have it playing a little cassette player on the tribal school bus. And here we up in Wyoming, and these kids are getting ready to go to war and play football, in that sense, the little brother of war, football. And, you know, I've heard it in that context. I've also been asked to sing it, you know, it seems ironic, but by a medicine person at a ceremony for someone who loved the song who passed away onto the other side, and is part of condolence and part of respect. And it was ironic to be asked to sing a contemporary song in a more traditional setting. But when I was singing it, it was from the heart, and it certainly becomes a folk song, and, you know, it becomes song of medicine, song of the people. And so I think the song has become a song of the people more than, you know, it's become a song of mine. And so these are some of the things that you know, I've experienced it in the context of Indian cars, from, you know, a total contemporary setting to a traditional, more somber, ritualistic type setting, to playing in a punk version in Toronto in a bar, you know, and Jody Mitchell's in the audience or something like that.
Well, Keith Cicola, I want to play another track from your new CD, which is called Finger Monkey. This song is called Can't Let Go. Would you introduce it for us? Tell us something about it.
This song is called Can't Let Go, and it's the song is a feeling of a desperateness, but yet a longing to keep going forward, you know, even when your heart says no and your mind says no, but the spirit got to keep going forward.
So this is Keith Cicola and Wild Band of Indians.
Not even Edie came out to greet me. Not even Frank gave a thing. I don't recall slipping and making a fall. Winter will soon cover us all. I don't think that she needs me. All I let go.
It's Keith Cicola on vocals and guitar from the new CD, Keith Cicola and Wild Band of Indians. Keith, I'm wondering if there's anything like a musical generation gap where you grew up between what the older and perhaps more traditional people liked and what the younger people liked musically.
I think, you know, of course, I think there's always change, you know, and cultures are dynamic. And Native music, for instance, has taken a dynamic approach. You know, even the contemporary powwow music that we hear in America, North America today, is a contemporary approach to from traditional roots. You know, as far as big drums, they weren't a real concept until the later part of the 18th and early part of this century, where we actually had marching drums turned sideways, horizontal, where people would sing around. There were drums and there were concepts of Native drums, but this whole contemporary movement started taking shape and form. And then you'd get the socialization of songs through tribal roots, you know, where singers couldn't understand each other, so English was used. And so there was this dichotomy where people were accustomed to these kind of songs from a tribal roots, and all of a sudden there was change, social change, where songs started to have English words, melodies started to have Western idioms in the concepts, and things like that. And so I think older people, you know, they have all this richness of tribalism, more of a ritualistic songs and things like that. And so they have a more of a wealthy source of what things were. And I think what things are today, I think that we're making a full circle as far as me for my life. And what I've learned is to appreciate music in all facets.
Keith, when you were growing up, were you more likely to hear rock music, to hear Springsteen and Neil Young, or more likely to hear traditional music, powwow music, or was it a combination of both?
Well, I think that is kind of, you know, a richness where you would be able to hear these both musics as far as who we are as Native people. I always thought that wherever, any reservation you could go across North America, you could find somebody that would know the chords to Mean Bobby McGee or some Creedence song. So it isn't like Native Americans are in isolation, but we're part of this general musical landscape that is a beautiful thing to be part of. And I think you'd hear both, you know, the AM, FM radio, such as in the commercial radio up in the North Woods. We'd mostly hear more pop music, but we would dive deeper and get, you know, the Dylan albums and get into a little bit the Grateful Dead and the Rolling Stones and stuff like that. And yet you would still hear, you know, the powwow music that would be sung, you know, on weekends or gatherings and things like that.
Did you grow up on a reservation?
I grew up near a reservation in northern Minnesota, Boys Fort Reservation, in Tower and in Net Lake.
Tell us something about the tribe that you're from.
I'm Anishinaabe. I'm a mixed-blood Anishinaabe from northern Minnesota. In Canada, we're known as Ojibwa. In the United States, we're known as Chippewa. And that was what our tribes enter into treaties with the United States government. And the word Anishinaabe has something to do with spontaneity. I think the spontaneous interaction of life. And as a person, Anishinaabe people, we act with the conditions we're given, you know, given with or given to or in the environment we're in. And so these are some of the concepts that I carry very dearly with me as an Anishinaabe person, the ability to be spontaneous, to have a stream of consciousness. I think that's the ability that connects a performer with the audience or a writer with his readers, or love connects love, that the ability of connecting consciousness. And I appreciate the word Anishinaabe, that spontaneous meaning of man. And that's something of what who I am as a person.
Now, I believe your mother was Anishinaabe and your father was an Italian immigrant?
Yes. My dad, his name is Orlando Sicola, and his mother and father, the father's name was Benny, but that's an American name, and Cora was my grandmother's name. They both immigrated to the North Iron Range of northern Minnesota in the early 19th century, and they had several children, and Orlando being one of the, I think the third child, grew up in the North Woods, and he married my mom, and they had children, and we grew up with other Native families in the area and other Italian people, and it was one glorious thing, I think, up there as far as people coming together and living. It was, if any place there was a melting pot that actually worked, it might have been up there. I remember when I was teaching after college, I taught a year in Hibbing High School, and I remember seeing the picture in the mural in the library, and there were almost like 32 different ethnic groups in that picture that went to high school and graduated that year. And so my Italian side that I'm very proud of. Now, later in my life, I'm learning more about this. And as I grew up as an Anishinaabe person, closer to the heritage of our people, but it was something very ironic that I remember my Italian grandfather, you know, and his grandmother would speak Italian, and I'd go to their house and I'd hear it, and I'd go up to Canada where my mother was from, and there was Anishinaabe spoken up there, and, you know, and you'd hear bits and words and things, and you didn't really even have a dichotomy as a child, you know, other than yeah, you know, your grandparents here, your grandparents there.
Did you feel like you were supposed to identify with one side more than the other, you know, more Native or more Italian?
You know, at different times in my life, it was, you know, it's an ugly thing, the prejudice and fear that children feel from the color of the skin, you know. I mean, I remember feeling somewhat shame of who I am as a Native person. In the summer times, you get dark and you'd feel like discrimination, and you'd feel, you know, like, oh, I wish I was more white or something like that. And then at other times you get discrimination of being Indian, of not being a full blood or something like that. And here you are, just a person, and trying to make the most of living.
So you didn't grow up on a reservation, but you grew up near one. How were you exposed to traditional music? Did you sit in on or participate in many ceremonies?
Well, you know, like I remember, for instance, during the ricing season in northern Minnesota, the wild rice, it's called Manomen, and we'd finish the rice, you know, you'd knock it off the stalk into canoes, and then you would dry the rice, and you'd have this process, but you would eventually dry it, and you'd winnow it, and eventually you would dance on it, you know, to get the kernels away from the fruit or the meat of the fruit of the rice. And now I remember they had certain songs called jigging songs, you know, like my little sister or my sister, older sister, who was smaller, would be a jigger, and they would let her dance on the rice, and, you know, like an uncle would sing songs. And, you know, you can remember some of these simple, almost like children child's nursery Indian songs, you know, ricing songs that would just talk about dancing, about happiness and things like that. And some of that exposure, early exposure, was part of the richness of who I was as a contemporary artist. And then, of course, you know, playing a trombone in a marching band, and then hearing Bob Dylan or Neil Young on the radio, I think it all led to a blend of my music today.
Can you sing a few bars of one of the Indian songs that your sister would dance on the rice to?
A lot of the songs, you know, would just like be vocable songs, like, you know, it'd be playful and like sometimes making up songs, you know, like something, look at her dance, she's funny, or acting crazy, or, and, you know, there was more of a spontaneity in that kind of a setting. But like the ritual songs, they're specific, and they're more of, you know, they're sung in a certain way and things like that.
You explained that your father's Italian, and I'm wondering if he ever participated in or was much interested in Native ceremony or Native history, or,
Terry, I think that, I mean, my father's influence on me as far as a Native person, he taught me many traditional things that aren't even, you know, he's not from that traditional Native culture, but he taught me a lot of respect for our people. As far as the way he would, you know, when we were growing up on the Iron Range, he was a house painter, and he'd always have Native people who would need a part-time job or something, he would always hire them. You know, my family was never felt, from my father, never felt like, I mean, Native people, we were special, and my father made us feel that way, as you know, that his children have Native blood in them and they're special. And so my dad was very influential, because a lot of Native people, when he died, came down from the reservations when we were, you know, my father passed away, and we had his ceremony for him in the Native way. And, you know, we had a drum there, and we sang for him, and we played music, and people would, you know, he was respected by the Native community. We had a lot of condolences, and by the way he lived, I mean, his favorite story would be on Appreciating Life, he would tell me about this one, Native person he knew. He would you know, always be kind of living in Virginia, Minnesota, would never have money for a cup of coffee or anything like that, but he'd see my dad, and my dad would take him in and buy him a meal at a cafe, and he would always describe how this one uncle of mine would drink his first sip of coffee, how much he appreciated, you know, how much he appreciated that, just that sip of coffee in the morning. And that story alone, my dad would tell me something about our culture.
Let me play another track from Finger Monkey. And this is a track that I think is very influenced by traditional Native music. It's called PMM. Say something about what's going on musically in this and what PMM stands for.
Plastic Medicine Man are the what it stands for. And musically, it's interesting. I mean, I'm taking a flute, a contemporary flute that it was a contemporary Native flute in the key of D, and I'm playing a D minor scale. And I went into a grand piano, and I'm plucking the strings. I opened up the heart of the piano, and I'm plucking the bass or the strings with a pick, you know, in syncopation, and we processed that sound. And then we did a drum program to underline the whole song, put the whole thing together, and I did some rattles and things like that. And the idea of a plastic medicine man is something maybe we can talk about.
Okay, why don't we hear the music first?
Yeah.
PMM from Keith Sokola's new CD, Finger Monkey. And Keith, that's you playing everything on there. Who did you learn music from? Did you teach yourself?
I always was singing. And, you know, even going to the doctor. And I remember the doctor had asked me to sing a song. It might have been a nursery rhyme or something. But I remember always standing up and singing a song before he'd look in my mouth or something like that. And so music was all around. I played trombone in grade school. You know, I started playing in the youth marching bands, you know, in the instrumental programs across the United States, all these great, wonderful musical programs that we have in the schools. And so I started to become interested, and I realized I could play the trombone. Eventually, you know, after high school, I pursued... I got my first Gibson Marauder guitar, and I pursued playing guitar. It was a lifetime pursuit. You know, I mean, the string instruments, as far as from that point on, I've been playing guitar over 20 years now, either folk or electric. And I play the flute now more of a therapeutical thing. In 1989, I had what's known as an acoustic neuroma, a brain tumor, that it caused me to have, I lost hearing in one ear, in my right ear. And I also had palsy in my face for a long time. I used to blow her blues harp. I started that the same time as guitar. And so not having the whole armature that you need for supporting a trombone or a cornet or a trumpet or a blues harp, like you really need a strong armature or mouth, strong mouth muscles, and having palsy, it weakened the strength of my mouthpiece. So I kind of switched, and I started playing therapeutical flute, you know, using the flute and using music as healing medicine for my own self, you know, and realizing how music can heal. And the American Native flute was something that was as natural as anything I've ever done.
Do you still have the palsy, and does it affect speaking or singing? It doesn't seem to.
Terry, not, you know, I guess I could hear it just barely, you know. I mean, it was 10 years ago, and it was a scary, scary thing. I mean, you're facing your own mortality as far as, and you have little children, and you know, you have all these ideas, and you barely got any of them out there yet. And it was like, it took me a couple years to start, even a whole year before I even got to move the right side of my face, you know. And you're walking around like with that, it's, you really learn some things. And for me to lose hearing in one ear and being a musician, it's like you learn to hear with your heart. And it's an ironic thing, you know. I think it's very ironic that, you know, I'm very fortunate to make a living playing music, you know, with, you know, having an impairment.
Yeah. So let's get back to the title of the piece that we heard, PMM, Plastic Medicine Man. Does that relate to the medical stuff you were just telling us?
Some, Terry, I think. The Plastic Medicine Man, he can crawl between the crack of the night and day. He can reach down your throat and grab a penny from your soul. He can make you want things you don't need, need things you don't want. Sweats, ceremonies, rituals, war paint, drums, pom-poms, crystals. Descendant of a pale moon, he ain't arrogant, he's ignorant. And these kind of the things, as far as the Plastic Medicine Man, he's misleading us. All these kinds of things. I know in some townships you can go and you can apply and get what's known as a chiefing license, and it would allow you to dress in your regalia or dress in your headbands and beads and take pictures legally with tourists and make money off of them in that way. And so some of this Plastic Medicine Man is, of course, it's a commentary about the fake shamanism and things like that that you feel in America, but also not just Native America, in all religions, you know, how we get misled by people, and people with needs are easily misled because we're desperate.
So the description of the Plastic Medicine Man, is that from a song lyric?
You know, when I go and play the song, I kind of go into this rant, and I ranted a few lines from the lyrics just now, yeah.
Right, okay. So you're pretty cynical about a certain... what romanticized version of Native Americans and full regalia and all of that. But you sometimes dress in Native clothes on stage. I've seen in a video you with that. Where do you draw the line about when to do the full regalia and when you find it really offensive?
Well, I think, you know, like we've asked, you know, some of our elders, as far as Albert Muntisinkwa, our traditional drummer, and I, we've talked to elders as far as, you know, bringing that drum into places. It was an issue that we had considered, you know, because some of the places we were playing in is in a bar, you know, is in a bar, the farthest thing from where this concept of a Native drum should be. And so it's a line where we know, like, if it's in more of a theater atmosphere where we can control the elements and we can bring beauty and respect, then we will use it. And the songs too that we use, they're all social songs, and usually the composers are myself or Albert will compose the Native songs. And so we're not taking any copyright as far as from tradition in that sense, and using social songs. So we try to not misappropriate in that way and try to be respectful in the other way, as far as where it should be seen. And, you know, if we're playing in a bar, we'll just play rock music and we'll play blues and stuff like that, that is commonplace. If we're playing at the Heard Museum in Phoenix, maybe we will do something like that more. Or if we're playing on a TV show, or I think that depends on, you know, the environment we're in depends. Certainly our show, kind of show that we're going to entertain people with. And then the environment, we, you know, determines what kind of songs we would sing too, you know. And I give you a variety of situations where we could be in. But it's a common question that I think is a continually to be reminded as an artist, is, you know, to always ask that question, you know, where and what are we really trying to do? Are we just trying to make this a novel thing and sell because... we got Indians and feathers, and I think Native culture is more than beads and feathers. And so it isn't something I want to do to Anglo face or to Indian face my music to make it a novelty, because I think that's wrong, you know, just to do it in that respect. But as a Native person, I think we have an obligation to our people as we, where we came from, to show our culture and to show our strengths. And so I think that that balance is always is important. It's important that people recognize that too. And they can see the cheesy and then they can see the real.
I want to play a song of yours from an earlier CD, and this song is called Fry Bread. And I think a lot of people who, a lot of people learned about Fry Bread from the movie Smoke Signals, mm-hmm. in which Fry Bread was something the characters were very nostalgic for. You know, one of the mothers made it all the time. What is Fry Bread, and what place did that have in your life?
Fry Bread's a lot of things. It's kind of, it's become a metaphor. But what is fry bread? It's fried bread, actually. I mean, if you looked at the early exchange between treaty rights and food exchange and things like that, commodities were often ushered into reservations in place of other things, and you can't do much with sugar, flour, and lard. And so it kind of came of the early 20s and 30s and 40s, where people were making ends meet, and to use this sugar, flour, and lard, we made a bread and we fried it, and it was born of all these things. I mean, fry bread is like soul food, Native soul food. It ain't so good for your health, but it's good for your soul. You know, fry bread is a symbol of that tenacity, of that survival.
Well, let's hear the song Fry Bread. This is Keith Sokola.
She said, all I'm asking for, settle down out on the edge of town, far from the neon lights, under the stars so bright. Fire glows and flickers between the cactus prickers out on the edge of town. He wants to settle down. All I'm asking for, fry bread.
Keith Sokola, now I know your song Indian Car has become very popular. What about Fry Bread? What kind of reaction have you gotten from listeners on that?
I get a lot of Fry Bread smiles. You know, a lot of children will come up and be eating Fry Bread and say the word Fry Bread to the people of the band. I think it was in June, we played in Toronto. Somebody handed me a bag of Bannock bread, which is Canadian version of, or the Ojibwa version of fry bread. And I was able to throw it, you know, pass out pieces of fry bread during the concert. It was kind of like passing out grand prizes. People were running up for it, trying to catch them. And so it's been a wonderful showpiece for myself and the band to showcase Native culture. During a song, we improvise a little bit, and we all get down and we say that we got to be quiet because 100 years ago, it was illegal to make fry bread, and there was all these illegal fry bread camps around North America practicing the art of fry bread, because all our grandparents wanted to do was hand a piece of fry bread down to their great-grandchildren. That's all we wanted to do. So they had to practice this illegal art of making fry bread. So every Friday night or every month, they'd get together in this hall and practice the art of fry bread making. And the story, it goes on, you know, you can include it here and there, but the concept of this being very old, you know, that our ancestors are handing something down to us, and that strength and survival. And it ain't just about Native people, because the last verse of Fry Bread, Peaky Bread, Popovers, Pumpernickel, Oven Bread, Rye Bread, all these things of different breads. You know, in Italy, I know that if you dropped a piece of bread, you know, the custom would be to pick it up and kiss the bread, you know, like you bless it, you know. And so you'd see the sacredness of bread all over, you know. And people want to know what happens if you dropped a piece of bread in Greece. And, you know, I say fry bread.
Are there things that have been helpful and other things that have been limiting in terms of being, you know, a band that's known as a native band?
Well, you know, the native band, first of all, the band members in the current lineup of the Wild Band is Jimmy Vickers on bass guitar, Munti Cinqua on traditional drums, Derek Miller on guitar, and Matthew Jones. Now, each member, with the exception of Jimmy, is from a tribal heritage. And, you know, some of the limitations, I think, from being in a native band is part of the economic deprivation culturally, I think, that I'm not blaming in society or anything like that, but just that economic deprivation that we've come from to kind of make the Indian genre is just starting now to mature. It's pretty infant in the sounds that are coming out right now, and it's just something that's commercially becoming, you know, acceptable. I think the sales of Native America records this last year have increased fivefold, and so it's just a new genre. And so some of the limitations as far as with a Native artist, you're faced with being a good business person, being in the music business, to know that you make money in separate ways just besides the live performances. You know, there's the merchandise end that should be controlled and the publishing end that you should have access to as an artist. And those kind of limitations that, for me, in my life, I'm learning right now. And to be sovereign is almost like individual sovereignty, economic sovereignty, all these kind of things that we're not grown up with. And I know, you know, as far as most musicians aren't accustomed to these kind of things where we would have a budget going into a studio. You know, so you have to improvise with the limitations that you're given. But almost by being more economical and being more thrifty, you become more pure in that sense of you become more efficient, and you manage your time and money a little better, and you improvise to make this happen. You know, like the Finger Monkey album, it was working with limitations, you know. And this time around, I'll get the album listed in Best Buy, and I'll have it on my website and things like that, and we're always taking it a step more. But I think the limitations most native bands are facing is that the music business, you know, understanding the business part of the music business.
Keith Cicola and Wild Band of Indians has a new CD called Finger Monkey. They'll perform at the Sundance Film Festival later this month. Here's more from the new CD.
Rosie ran out of gas. In the great north woods, she was running from her past. Now she's sorting out her goods. When she went to make her call, the chief of the tribe, when she returned, police chief arrived. And it's funny about
Rosie ran out of gas.
Coming up, Milo Miles on the Savoy label and new reissues from its vaults. This is Fresh Air.